This week on Writers, Inc.
There is absolutely no better exercise for building the muscles a writer needs than translating from another language into English.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So am I the only one out of this group that's obsessed with this Nancy Guthrie thing?
You're definitely more obsessed than I am.
Look, yeah, you're the most, I think.
My wife is completely obsessed by it, and I get to hear about it all the time. And it's not that I'm not interested. It's just that I'm packing and moving a bunch of stuff. So I don't have time to solve an unsolved murder right now or kidnapping.
Well, it's tough to watch. Like, there's hardly any print news on it, which I think is kind of weird. You know, I can only stomach so much of the cable news channels, but you know, if you turn it on for like 5 minutes, you basically get all the facts, and then they repeat those 5 minutes over and over again for the next 23 and a half hours. Yeah. But you know, like I'm learning stuff that like there's certain things I've thrown in books that I just assumed was possible, but I didn't realize that it actually is possible. And like, I just listened to a report where they were talking to one of the tech guys, and he was saying that like, you know, if this bad guy just drove through a neighborhood, you know, his phone is basically trying to log into every Wi-Fi that it passes. So even if he didn't actually acknowledge it by clicking a button on his phone, all of those routers have a log of that. Huh. And it makes you think about the trail that we all leave behind. You know, like as a bad guy, like carrying a phone is just stupid. I'm hoping, you know, like I know my bad guys leave those at home when they go off and do something in the book.
Yeah, I think most do. I actually like how a lot of thriller authors will creatively get rid of the phone somehow. You know, like just kind of make it like it breaks or there's no reception or just something, how it gets waterlogged, something to sort of eliminate that. Because, yeah, phones are a problem.
Well, here's a fun fact for you. Most modern cars, like within the past 20 years, have some kind of transponder built into them as well. So even if you don't have a phone, your vehicle may be telling towers that you drove through. And that's actually much easier to link to you.
So you have to commit crimes on a bike.
Do your crimes on a bike. No phones.
Not an e-bike, maybe.
No, just a manual bike.
Just a normal bicycle.
I kind of want to go in the opposite direction, and I want to create a bad guy who has to carry his phone. Yeah, so if we take, Kevin, I'm going to pick on you. So you've got a pacemaker. I'm guessing your phone is part of that process. Like, can you actually go, like, I know your pacemaker doesn't need your phone to operate, but I'm guessing you keep your phone with you because of the pacemaker, probably more than some, like, I've got a neighbor whose daughter is diabetic, and, like, she carries a phone with her all the time to be able to monitor that stuff.
Yeah.
If I had to monitor it that closely, I definitely would, but I don't. So, and if it were, like, a defib pacemaker or something, it could actually warn me ahead of time if I was going to have an incident. But mine is just it's just like a spare battery for my heart, basically. So it doesn't need the phone necessarily.
Yeah.
I do have it linked to the phone.
I need to put some thought into it. I'm thinking like a bad guy who is dependent on his, like has to have his phone with him no matter what, now has to, you know, like overcome that particular obstacle and whatever.
Digital leash. Like,
yeah. So that could be kind of fun.
My son is type 1. So yeah, he has CGM, his glucose monitor, and his pump are hooked up to his phone. And he can put his insulin in from his phone because, you know, he doesn't like unclipping his pump and putting it in. But he doesn't need his phone. So the question is then, I wonder if the pump gives out a signal on its own. That would be interesting to know.
I'm sure that stuff is coming too. I mean, I sent you guys a question to the group, you know, just wondering how some of these things connect. And like at some point, they're not going to need the phone anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like the phone is just, it's doing a lot of the heavy lifting. But, you know, 5 years from now, all that's going to be built into these devices, which means the devices are going to be checking in with routers and doing these different things.
Yeah. Well, you didn't respond to my my assertion there that what that guy had in his mouth was a flashlight tongue ring.
I honestly think it's a gold tooth. You know, like
no,
if you
it's
watch
a flashlight. They've already figured, they've already identified it.
Oh, what was
Did
it?
They?
Kara told me that they found it as a flashlight.
In his mouth?
Oh, I didn't see that. Because you can't see a flashlight. Like when he turns his head to the side, it doesn't look like there's anything in his
well,
mouth.
He's doing all kinds of crazy stuff in the video. And, you know, for like he has a harness for his weapon and it's like right dangling in front of him like a phallus.
So that I've heard is called a Mexican carry.
That's right.
You know, like, so that's a specific type of way to put your holster. So I can write that one off. But like, what kind of bad guy shows up at a house, you know, and tries to block the Ring camera with some weeds that he just pulls from the brush? Yeah, just it shows, you know, like when we write a book and you write a bad guy, you know, like you're typically our bad guys are pretty smart. We think this stuff through. But, you know, like in real life, they don't do that. They don't get that opportunity. And this is why they're the bad guys and why most of them are in jail. And now it's,
this is why the bad guys, they get caught,
Yeah.
Yeah.
The smart ones don't get caught.
Like, it's kind of hard. Like, you can't base a lot of things on reality. Like, you can, like, use it as inspiration. But, like, you could be like, oh, that really happened. And it's like, yeah, but a reader's not going to buy it. Like, just because it happened in real life doesn't mean that it's plausible in fiction.
That's right.
Which I think is so funny to think about.
Jenna, was that an intentional setup for our interview? Because it, I totally felt like it.
Yeah.
No, I just know that, you know, when you're, you know, we've all like, you know, beta read a book where it's like, no, that really happened. And it's like, okay. And I say this with love, but that doesn't matter.
If you write punching a shark, people call you out on it. I found out and I'm like, but that's what you're supposed to do.
I know, but I know it's so interesting that real life often isn't plausible for fiction.
Yeah.
Especially my real life.
I'm sure.
All right.
Kevin, what's in the news?
In the news, Draft Digital and Bookshop DRM. Bookshop.org flags ebooks as DRM free by default when distributed via Draft Digital, which can surprise authors. DRM settings must be manually adjusted in the DDD account, and DRM enabled titles are currently readable only in the Bookshop app, with Kindle and Nook compatibility unresolved. Bookshop and DDD leadership actively encourage DRM-free ebooks, arguing that reader demand for portability and device flexibility makes DRM-free indie titles a strategic advantage to Bookshop's platform and a way to attract non-Amazon ebook buyers.
What do you think about that? That's the DRM. So we did the bookshop.org is paired up with Draft Digital.
Yeah.
But indies have to make their books DRM-free.
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of being DRM free because you know, I want my readers to be able to read on the device of their choice. And I've never seen that it significantly discourages piracy or anything like that.
Yeah.
So there doesn't seem to be a legitimate reason for it other than being able to lock you into a specific platform. So,
well, with you being the biggest criminal of the group, you probably know the answer to this. How hard is it to strip the DRM off?
It can be
like
done.
I remember back in the day when DVDs came out, like it took, you know, like just the software was always up to date. Yeah. You could always strip the security off. So I'm guessing there's a way to do this, right?
I'm not admitting to being the quote biggest criminal in the group, but I will say it can be done. There is the tools are out there. In fact, I think maybe is it Calibre or Calibre? I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce it. I think that might actually.
I have that program, but I've never tried to strip DRM with it. Because, you know, I can get those from the library and authors.
I don't know.
Paid.
I'm so
but,
pure and
you know.
I can't recommend that anybody remove DRM. If it's on there, then the author intended to be on there. Leave it alone. But it shouldn't be on there.
My point is this type of security has never worked with stuff in the past. It never keeps the bad guys from getting to it, but it is keeping good people from being able to get to your book if you have the DRM on there. So I've never put it on just for that reason.
Yeah, I guess kind of the question about this is why indie books have to be DRM free when the traditionally published books don't. So, you know, there was some thought about we already have the price lower and, you know, it's harder to discover. But the bad books are protected.
This probably has a lot to do with Draft to Digital. D2D had we always had a policy of you know, pushing authors to not do DRM. And so they may when presented with it, it's possible that they said, "Hey, look, let's turn it off by default."
Yeah.
And you know, the authors
So
can turn it on if they want,
you
because
can turn it
most
back on, but then I think that prevents you from getting on the bookshop, right? Your ebook.
it might, I don't
I
know,
don't know.
but
Something to look into anyway.
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, Unhappy Returns. Harper's Bazaar's 2026 short story contest quietly reinstated a controversial copyright transfer, requiring the winning author to give up full copyright rather than simply licensing publication rights, a practice widely criticized as unnecessary and author unfriendly. The rights language is ambiguously worded and buried in dense fine print, meaning entrants could easily miss it. While legal experts say only the winner is affected, it's still considered a bad idea for writers. Yeah,
Yeah.
Well,
I
this is one of
agree.
those, a lot of these magazines actually do that. They take the copyright on stuff that the bigger publications, but what kills me about this is they're hiding it. Like they're not telling people they're
Yeah.
doing it. They snuck it in the fine print and they're, you know, hoping to slip it past them. And that's not cool.
I mean, any magazine I've ever published with got like first North American rights or something like that. They didn't get the full
Full
copyright.
copyright. Yeah, and I guess they did this in 2019 and there was an outcry about it. The Harper's so bizarre. So they removed it and then they just kind of quietly stuck it back in there, which is not cool. So writer beware.
No.
Know what you're
Yeah, that's
signing. Yeah.
well, it's a revenue center for them. Like they not only print it in Harper's Bazaar, but they can take it and they can put it in other things. They can then license it to an anthology and put it here and put
Yeah.
it there and, you know, basically take the revenue out of the author's pocket.
Yeah. It's just another reason to be cautious of contests, I guess. So,
And contracts. I mean,
yeah, and
anymore,
kind
you just
read
have
every
to really,
contract.
yeah,
Yeah.
read and I mean,
Yeah.
even like maybe even have a lawyer look over it just because you never know
Yeah.
anymore. Like,
If
if
nothing else, run it through AI and
you
ask for red flags. If nothing else, do that. I'm not saying that's the smartest thing. I'm just saying that's an option. All right. Last story. For some reason, someone who generates AI slop books has unmasked herself. Coral Hart, a romance author and publishing coach, claims she used AI tools like Claude and Grok to mass produce 200 plus romance novels and sell them on Amazon without disclosing they're AI generated, saying she's made six figures from roughly 50,000 sales. Hart asked the Times to keep her real name anonymous, stating disclosure could hurt her other work, yet allowed a real photo of her face to be published, making the anonymity feel shaky. Hart is also selling courses and mentorship, promoting, quote, skip the draft style packages and tools that claim to turn an outline into a near finished novel quickly, framing it as a scalable production system for rapid publishing. Gizmodo frames the whole situation as bizarre and revealing. Hart openly treats publishing like a speed and volume race to write a book in a day. Insists the output is still, quote, quality, and seems driven less by huge wealth than by making a steady income by cranking out AI books at scale. If you're gonna write a book in a day, come buy it honest, like some of us have. That's
Yeah.
all I'm saying.
I immediately hate this person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
This is so typical, though. It's such a typical thing where it's like, oh, I'm doing this thing, and if you pay me $200 or $1,500 or whatever, I'll teach you to do it too. And I've seen so much of this in the business. It's just getting worse with the AI movement.
Yeah. I just don't I don't know. I mean, I do think that there is probably a certain kind of reader who maybe doesn't care about the AI, but like to say that you can like I look at AI. Do you remember like in the 90s when like all those diet foods came out and it was like, you know, fat-free everything and
Yeah.
everyone ate it and it was like the big thing, but it like wasn't really filling and like it wasn't really good and then it turned out to have like health problems and then like it kind of like declined because it was just like empty. Like that's
Yeah.
how AI feels and I feel like it's sort of like a novelty right now so everyone's going to do it but like it's not really filling and it's not really
Yeah.
satisfying. It's probably going to make you sick and so everyone's going to stop using it. Like it's not going to be just
Yeah.
empty.
You know
Yeah.
what? Where I got stuck here was on the math. So she made 50,000 sales on more than 200 books, which is
Right.
less than $250 a book.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's
Yeah.
not really very good.
No.
I'm just saying.
Well, he said made six figures from roughly 50,000 sales. So she made six figures with 200 books.
Oh, 50,000 sales. Okay, I see.
Yeah.
But that's still less than, so it's less than 250 sales a book.
Yeah,
So she's
something like that.
selling roughly
But that's
200
still
copies.
not
That's
good.
not good.
No,
Like
that's not
that.
good. No, yeah, that's the whole bulk model, right? And I'm gonna say I kind of want people to do this. I want a lot of people to do this, and here's why. Because it's ultimately it's gonna burn itself out. Like people are gonna get tired of seeing
Well,
garbage, and those of us that are writing the books, we roll in. I mean, maybe distinction and differentiation is going to become challenging, but that's always been a
maybe
challenge.
this is
So,
why traditional publishers are trying direct sales. They are expecting it to swing back and people to be looking to them as tastemakers. I don't know. And quality, we'll see.
maybe this is why we need DRM. I don't know. Is this a DRM scenario?
I don't know. I don't know anything anymore.
One of my checks, whenever if I stumble into like a Kindle book that I want to get because the description is good, one of the first things I always look at is I try to see who the publisher was, and if it's the same person, like their name is repeated under the publisher, or you can tell that it's some, that they're doing this on their own. Like I kind of treat that as a red flag. And I probably shouldn't, but I think my next check is going to be if they've got 400 books under their name, and they're all published like in the last year, I'm probably not going to pick up that title.
This is what I was saying. If you, that's the that's a problem, really, because if you, there are people who are prolific. Maybe they don't have 400 books, but I had a goal at one time that I wanted to do like the Pulp Fiction writers and have like 1500 books, and I was going to, plow through and do that. And now there's a disadvantage to having more titles. I don't know. I don't know what the answer here is, because I want to continue writing until I'm dead, and that means there's going to be a lot of books.
I don't
Is that
know,
going
but
to hurt me?
when I was young and more pretentious about things in general, I would only buy books based on their publisher. I know people would be like, nobody buys books on their publishers. I
Nobody
did.
buys books based on
No,
I used to.
I still do actually. Like I think I am warier of, certain presses and indie, and like you just don't know. And so like you do have to like kind of read the sample and get familiar with things and trust like word of mouth more, because like there's just so much out there. Like I want to make sure that I'm going to actually like set myself up for success versus, not. And I know what kind of styles I like. And so you kind of start trusting specific imprints and specific authors. And even if you look in the back, I always do, but like who the editors are, and like you kind of develop trust for that. Like, okay, this person is going to be good. Okay.
I could see, and this is possible. I don't know if this would help, but it might be a scenario where the sample becomes the selling point for it. If you can read the first couple of pages, so maybe there would be an advantage to just putting like the opening of the book on the book description rather than trying to use the old tried and true
There's
marketing
an interesting
swing.
idea. Here's the first three pages.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
You know that manuscript you've been editing for the past year? The one that's almost done, but never quite gets there? Well, right now, it's crying out for help from this episode's sponsor, AutoCrit. Quite possibly the most powerful all-in-one writing platform, AutoCrit puts an entire publishing team in the palm of your hand. Get access to customizable automated alpha and beta readers, plus series-wide story analysis, marketing support, line editing tools that can help you catch the mistakes you miss, and even more, including exclusive craft events only for members. The value is insane, and right now you can grab lifetime access for just one payment. No monthly fees, no usage limits, no caps, no tokens. At AutoCrit, unlimited means unlimited. It's time to finish your book. Start making real progress, escape revision limbo, and publish with confidence story after story. Check out autocrit.com/JD to save 50% on lifetime membership right now. That's autocrit.com/JD.
JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Benjamin Hale on. Benjamin's writing has appeared in Harper's Magazine, Paris Review, The New York Times, Washington Post, and many others. He also teaches at Bard University in Columbia. He's got a new book called Cave Mountain, A Disappearance and a Reckoning in the Ozarks, based on his real-life disappearance of his cousin. This should be good. Benjamin Hale.
Well, I'm looking forward to this chat with Benjamin. We didn't establish what I should call you up front, I guess, but Benjamin Hale. You go by a middle initial? Didn't you have a middle initial I'm missing?
No, I mean, there's a middle initial on my, credit card, but
I
no,
see.
My
That's what it was. I was charging your credit card, and
no, I'm Benjamin Hale on the dotted line and on a book cover, but everyone who knows me calls me Ben.
Okay, Ben, and yeah, we were having a quick discussion before the show that I have another author friend whose name is Ben Hale, who writes under the name Ben Hale.
Right.
And then you told me about a whole other writer who's a philosopher.
Right.
So there's
yeah.
a lot. I didn't realize there was that many Ben Hales in the world. So,
I mean, it's not like Jack Smith, but it is a fairly common name.
Yeah. So you, we're going to be talking about your new book, which is called Cave Mountain. But before we dive into that, we kind of like to get a little bit of the origin story of writers. So let's start there. Like, what was it that, how did you get here? How did you become a writer? What led you here?
I have wanted to be a writer, from a pretty early age. I remember wanting to, to be a writer when I was a teenager. I wanted to be an artist of some sort, and actually the first thing that I did as a writer was journalism, and I wanted to be a journalist, but I what I really wanted to do was write fiction, The most formative period of time for me as a writer, or like building my life and style, and kind of honing my style, the biggest leap forward that I ever had was I dropped out of college after my sophomore year, and then I spent a year. I was working various jobs, but ultimately the job that I did the most for that year was working at a bakery, baking bagels, in the middle of the night. I would have to get to work at, 3 a.m. And I would work the 3 a.m. to like 10 or 11 a.m. shift, and then come home to the apartment that I shared with a roommate, and I would read and write all afternoon. And I barely got any sleep that year, but like it was a year of totally self-directed and obsessive reading and writing, and at the end of that year I felt like I had fought with the Balrog and come back as Gandalf the White, and then ever since then I've just, it was just, this is a year of immersive reading and writing. And ever since then, I've been pretty confident in my style as a writer, and pretty confident in the way that I just kind of, can swim through sentences on the page. It's my medium,
Yeah.
And then I finished college. I majored in classics, and translating ancient Greek was another thing that really made me as a writer. It's something that I often tell my writing students. I teach it at Bard College and at Columbia, but something I often tell students who want to be writers is there is absolutely no better exercise for building the muscles a writer needs than translating from another language into English.
Yeah.
Because it forces you to slow down and think about the grammatical structure of every sentence very carefully, and it forces you to make decisions. It forces you to think, am I going to use this word or this word, and why? Because you have to take into account how accurate it is to the original, but also the connotations to a native English speaker who's going to be reading this. And you've got to think about all the reasons why you choose one word over another, and that's exactly what a good writer does, you know. And so between that year in the wilderness, getting up at 2 in the morning every night and reading and writing all afternoon, and then translating ancient Greek in college, those are the things that really kind of I feel like forged me as a writer. I was writing, after college, I painted houses for a while. I, did all kinds of stuff, and eventually, I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I just absolutely loved the place. It was incredible. And then the 3 years that I spent in Iowa, that also really it furthered my craft as a writer and career, I suppose. It's, that's the idea is to do both. And by the time I was done at with the 3 years that I was living in Iowa, I left the place with a finished draft of what became my first published book, which was a novel, The Evolution of Bruno Littlemore, that came out in back in 2011. And then 5 years after that, I published a collection of short stories called The Fat Artist. And then in the past, after I published that novel, I did a lot of science writing because the book has a lot to do with animals and evolutionary biology, which are subjects that I'm really interested in. They're very crucial to that novel, and so I had a kind of interesting side career for a little while as a science writer, which I really enjoyed because I really loved talking to scientists and then kind of distilling it in a way. I may perhaps I flatter myself, but I like to think that I'm pretty good at like at talking to scientists, listening to what they're saying, and then understanding it and explaining it in a way that a lay reader would understand it. And so I did that for a time, and then I started teaching at Bard, and my science writing kind of I haven't done it for a while. But and then this book, Cave Mountain, it was it's based on an article I wrote in Harper's a couple of years ago, and I should have written this story a long time ago. I'm kind of kicking myself for not getting to it sooner, mostly because if I had written this, say, 5 years ago instead of, now, several of the key people in the story were still alive who have died since then, and I wasn't able to talk to them. So, I should have written this book like a decade ago, but I didn't.
I mean, what was it that did you have the idea a decade ago, or how long ago did this come up?
I thought about kind of I thought about basing a novel on this story, and I wrote a little bit of that. I got maybe a chapter into it before kind of realizing that this wasn't the way to do it. And then I think what put the idea in my mind was that maybe this is perhaps like 5 years ago or so. We had a friend visiting us, we just got to talking about this story, and I just told the whole story verbally to this friend that we were having dinner with, and she was like, "Why have you not written this? This is an incredible story." And I was like, "Maybe I should." So I wrote the Harper's article, and now this book, and also, I mean, it's a different story than it was when I used to just tell it verbally to people. Because in the course of writing the Harper's article and then doing the research for the book and writing the book, I uncovered stuff that I believe I'm the first person in this story to have unearthed a couple of critical pieces of information So the story has actually changed because of my working on it.
Yeah. So, okay, we should loop back real quick and talk about what the book is about, because it's got a subtitle. It's Cave Mountain is the title, A Disappearance and a Reckoning in the Ozarks, which, you know, implies some things.
Right.
What is the actual story here? What are you exploring?
So the story is my cousin, my little cousin, who's she was a 6-year-old girl at the time, Haley. She was on a hike with her grandparents, Jay and Joyce Hale, who are my aunt and uncle, and they were with a few friends hiking in a very remote, very rugged part of the Arkansas Ozarks. My whole family is from Arkansas, many generations back. You know, I grew up in Colorado, but both of my parents are from Arkansas. And when I was growing up, we would spend just about every Christmas in Arkansas and often go there in the summers too. So, you know, I've never lived there, but I know the place very well. She was on a hike with her grandparents, and she got lost. The way that happened was there was they were coming from a cabin, the sort of the back way from the trail, not the official way to come to the trail from the trailhead, but they had some friends who had a cabin in this area that was behind the regular trail, and there was a little what's called a social trail, just, you know, a friend's trail that leads down to the official trail that they were hiking on. They were coming from that cabin, and they first went to the Hawksbill Crag, which is a famous Arkansas landmark. It's a really beautiful, like arrow of rock that juts out above this cliff. It's about 250 feet above the pretty much sheer vertical drop above the Buffalo River. So they went to that, saw that, and then continued on a little bit to where there's a waterfall. It's also on the edge of the same cliff, but about you know, not even half a mile away. And they got to that waterfall, and the problem was this was the first hike of the day, which was only like a mile. It was a very short hike. And then later they were going to go to a group hike that was sponsored by the Newton County Wildlife Federation, called to see the wildflowers. It was late April, and the wildflowers were kind of at the peak of their bloom. And that group hike started at 1, and so they got to the waterfall, and it was about noon, a little before noon, and at this waterfall, the trail is at the top of the waterfall, and you could only, you know, a waterfall is a picturesque sight, but only when you're on the bottom of it. You can't see it when you're at the top of it, and there's sort of a lower shelf of rock at this place that there is a way of kind of shimmying down this rock face and grabbing onto this tree and hopping down to the lower shelf, and you can get down there and see the waterfall. But it's difficult and a little dangerous to do. You know, my Uncle Jay was able to do it, and a friend that he was with, they scrambled down there, saw the waterfall, and then climbed back up. And Haley wanted to see the waterfall, but it was time to go because they had to get back to the cabin, eat lunch, and then go to the other hike that started at 1 o'clock. And so she wanted to see the waterfall. It was time to go. That was the situation. And she just threw a fit, you know, as a 6-year-old girl can and often does. And you know, she was being difficult. She sat down on a rock and refused to move. And you know, everyone else started going back, and my Aunt Joyce was like, "You guys go ahead, fix lunch. I'll stay down here and deal with the kid problem. I'll get her back somehow." Joyce exhorted her granddaughter to move off that rock. She couldn't get her to move, and Joyce kind of pulled the nuclear option of trying to get a kid to do something she doesn't want to do, which is play upon the fear of abandonment. Say, "I don't know about you, but I'm going," and then walk out of sight, wait kind of a while, because if you go back too soon, she'll know you're bluffing. And then sure enough, the kid will come. She did that a couple of times. Haley came, and then she tried it again. No Haley. And she was like, all right, went stomping back. Now I'm really mad. And she was gone. She was gone for 3 days. They couldn't find her. And it was a really, pretty, by the end of the day, there were about 100 people out looking for her. They called the local sheriff. There were police from neighboring districts that came in to help look, the park rangers. There was a guy who specialized in search and rescue missions with the Park Service, who organized the search and rescue mission operation. They had a couple of helicopters with heat-seeking devices toward the end of the day, and she was gone for 3 days. And the story of how she got found is kind of an incredible story too, because Haley's father was a National Guardsman, and he was in the middle of his annual 2 weeks of mandatory training at Fort Chaffee when this happened. And he got a call from his wife, my cousin Kelly. Haley is technically my first cousin once removed, but because her father, my Uncle Jay, is so much older than my dad, like 20 years, Haley and I feel more like of the same generation. That's why I call her my cousin. Well, Kelly is technically my cousin. And he got a call from her, and he, freaked out and ran over to the Cave Mountain in Newton County in the Buffalo National River Wilderness, where this takes place. And as he when he got that call, there was a friend in the guard who happened to be standing near him, Vixen James, who told him, "I'm from that area. I know that area of the Ozarks like the back of my hand." And shortly after Steve left to go join the search, Vixen and another friend asked their superior officer for leave to join the search. They got it. They went and joined the search, and then they helped with the search for the next 3 days that unfolded. And toward the end of that, there was they used search dogs, and it happened several times that some of the search dogs would pick up the scent they thought right around the area where Haley was last seen, and then they would follow it through the woods, and the dogs that would lose the scent at the edge of a dirt road that goes across Cave Mountain called Cave Mountain Road. And it always ended at the road every time they tried to search with dogs. And that led the police to think that that the reason they weren't finding her is because she wasn't there, that someone driving on that road had picked her up and taken her, abducted her. And on the third day, Steve and Kelly, they say that the first 48 hours are the critical window for a missing person. After that, the odds of finding the person alive drop off precipitously. And the police told them, okay, we're running out of options. We're running out of places to search. And they said that we are potentially moving from a search and rescue operation to a criminal investigation. And Steve and Kelly at that point started freaking out. They weren't before that moment at all. They were pretty clear-headed about it, and they were sure, no, she's got to be on here somewhere. I mean, there's this, it's an element in this book is the, moral paranoia about, how can some, evil pedophile be like, hiding behind a tree here in the middle of the woods? We're 30, literally 30 miles away from the nearest stoplight here,
I want to interrupt you a little bit because I want people to still want to read
For sure. I need
the
to, I need to work on, I still need to work on doing this more
No,
succinctly.
you're good. I just this story down pat for sure, and I just wanted to make sure you weren't giving away the whole basket here.
But wait, let me get to the speech. And so they were they Stephen Kelly gave a press conference at the end of that day. Meanwhile, Vixen James with the guard came to help out with the search. They weren't finding her, and then he went to his father who was a local guy who was a hunter, who had grown up in the area, knew it like the back of his hand, and said, "You gotta, help with the search." And his dad said, "We tried." He said he and his friend William Jeff Belines, they were hunting buddies. They hunted together all the time. He said they we went to the search area to volunteer to help, and they turned us away. And the reason they were turned away is because the people operating the search and rescue operation, they had too many volunteers. They were overwhelmed. It was becoming more of a problem to deal with all the volunteers than searching, and that's why they were starting to turn people away. And Vixen's father, Lytle James, and William Jeff Belines went looking for him along the low ground, along the banks of the Buffalo River. And the reason the search and rescue people weren't looking there is because they were convinced that she was still on top of the mountain somewhere. The trail is along the edge of a cliff. It's about a 250-foot drop, and it's pretty much sheer vertical drop. And they were convinced that the only way she could have gotten down was by falling off of it. So they looked for her corpse at the bottom of it, but didn't find it. That's why they thought she was still on top of the mountain. On that first day, unbeknownst to anyone, and it's not clear why, she climbed down. She found a place that was gentle enough slope to do this. She climbed down the mountain and got all the way down to the banks of the river on that first day. And then for the rest of the time, she was just wandering up and down the river. And they found her, and they brought her back, and she was okay. She was a little dehydrated, but there was nothing else wrong with her. They took her to the hospital and released her the next morning. And then after that, her parents wanted to they didn't like all the reporters camped out on the lawn. They didn't like what this was doing potentially psychologically to their daughter. So they took her away for a short trip of a few days. They asked her where she wanted to go. Her favorite thing she'd ever seen was the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. So they took a quick impromptu family vacation up to St. Louis. And on the way over there, she told her parents about the imaginary friend that she'd had when she was lost in the woods. She said she was very specific about it. She was 4 years old. Her name was Alicia. She had dark hair. She wore in pigtails. She wore a red shirt and purple pants and white sneakers, and she had a flashlight with her. And she said that she had had this friend, imaginary friend, from the moment she realized she was lost until the moment that she was rescued. And that kind of made their hair stand on end. And that story started circulating amongst all the adults who were involved in the operation. And then months later, there was this guy, Tim Ernst, who is a photographer who at the time lived in the area where Haley got lost, and he opened up his house to Haley's parents and grandparents and a lot of the people who were looking for her. They stayed at his place while the search was going on, and that guy became friends with the family. And a few months later, he sent an email to my Aunt Joyce saying, "My wife asked me the other day, we were talking about Haley's Alicia, and she asked me if there'd ever been any little girls who got lost or died in those woods." And I said, "Yes, actually, there was this crazy incident that happened sometime in the 70s where there was this cult that murdered a little girl and buried her in a 5 gallon plastic paint bucket in the woods, pretty close to where Haley got lost." And that sent my Aunt Joyce into detective mode, and she started looking into it. And the Benton County Police, because Tim remembered somehow that they had been taken to Benton County for some reason, which is, a good hour and a half away from Newton County where this happened, and it happened to be where Jane Joyce lived. And she asked the sheriff if they knew about this case or had any records of it, and they said no. But someone there said Tom Keith was involved in that case somehow. Tom Keith happened to be a pretty good friend of Jane Joyce's. He was about the same age, and he was, a Democrat, kind of a pillar of the community kind of guy. He and Jay had served together as volunteer firefighters and so on. And she went and asked him about it, and he said, "Yes. Before I was a judge, I was a public defender, and he said it was one of my first jobs out of law school. I was assigned to defend the only defendant who was accused of that crime, whose case went to trial, which was the mother of the girl who was murdered, who was a member of the cult. And there were four people who were arrested or convicted of that murder. The other three got very long prison sentences, he believed that the mother never should have been convicted, that she was just as much a victim of the cult as her daughter had been, and she shouldn't have been convicted or sentenced to any jail time. But you know, she was only sentenced to 5 years. She served half of that, and then she was only 22 when this happened. When she got out of prison, she was 25 and had the rest of her life in front of her. And she got married, had another family, and kind of lived the rest of her life. But she'd always kept in touch with Tom Keith, who had been a major, you know, she called him her rock. And Tom said to Joyce, "Well, you know, I'm in touch with her. Do you want me to put the two of you in touch?" And he did eventually, and they became friends, and they kind of, you know, sort of spooked each other out, convincing one another that Haley's imaginary friend was the, you know, spirit or something of her Lucy Clark's daughter. And it was kind of a very unlikely friendship that came out of it. And in Lucy's case, she said that this whole thing kind of was the only, that she had been, to say the least, racked with guilt ever since this had happened. And it was the only thing, believing that the spirit of her daughter had guided Haley to safety, was the only thing that closed the wound at all in her life. She said memorably in one of her emails, maybe that if she survived in some form to help Haley, then maybe she had to die to help Haley, and Haley had to live in order to help me in some sort of way.
Yeah.
I usually ended the story when I told it before I wrote the book. There's more.
Right. Yeah, no, but that's dramatic. There's a lot there. And unfortunately, we don't have a ton of time left, but I want to make sure that we talk about like some of the choices you made there. Because you mentioned that you had thought maybe about writing this as fiction, but you landed on nonfiction here. What made you decide to go that route? It sounds like you made the right choice, but
yeah,
was the final decision there?
The main reason is because the story is too strange to be a novel. It's too weird. It wouldn't be believable because there are just so many astounding coincidences, and you know, just like you know, in a novel, there has to be an internal sense of causality. Things have to make sense in order for fiction to work. Yeah. This is reality, and so it doesn't have to make sense. And you know, the bizarre twists and turns and eerie coincidences are all there. It's the story's too weird for fiction. That's why.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, so was the process of writing this dramatically different from the type of writing you did with fiction?
Yeah, I love writing fiction. I kind of consider that my main, you know, thing. But I also, you know, I mean, writing this book really harkened back for me to being a journalist. And you know, and it's a lot of fun to write journalism. You know, there's something writing this book, researching the book is much more fun than researching fiction, because you get to go and talk to people and meet people and, you know, go places and you know, be in the real world and interview people.
Yeah.
I love interviewing people. You know, I love, I came to love, like, oh, I don't know. One of my favorite moments when I was researching this book was I went to the sheriff's station in Newton County, Arkansas, in Jasper, a tiny, tiny town in the middle of a very rural area. And I was talking to the sheriff at the sheriff's station and asking for records from 1978. And I was looking through these records, and the guy was like, and the records from 1978 were extremely minimal. There was hardly anything there. And I was disappointed. And then the sheriff in Jasper said, "Well, you know, the guy who used to be sheriff a long time ago, and he used to be a deputy before that, Ray Watkins, you know, he's really old now, but he works at the hardware store right outside of town. You can probably still catch him. It's like 4:30 if you want to go talk to him. He was around, and he was part of the department back then." So I drove over there, and the guy he was talking about was working at the cash register at the hardware store. He's a 90-year-old man, and I asked him, "Did you used to be the sheriff of Newton County?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Do you know this incident with the cult that murdered the girl who was buried in the bucket in 1978?" And he said, "Yeah, I was the one who arrested him." And that was how I found him, you
Yeah.
know.
Yeah.
Like those amazing moments don't,
Little
you know.
serendipitous connections that you make as you go
Right.
along. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't
So.
happen so much when you're just sitting in your, you know, lonely garret trying alone with your brain trying to write a novel.
Right. Well, we have to wrap up, but this is very interesting, and I, you know, the sort of there's a sort of supernatural energy to it that I find fascinating. So I can't wait to check it out. But why don't you tell people where they can find you and the book?
You can find the book at after March 3rd, which is the pub date at your local bookstore or wherever you buy books. And you can find me. Let's see. I'm not doing. I don't have that many readings scheduled yet, but I've got one scheduled for March 12th here in Rhinebeck, New York, near where I live at Oblong Books. I'll be reading at Bard College on March 9th, and I'll be reading at Prairie Lights in Iowa City, Iowa on March 23rd.
All right. And you have a website
That's right. My website is benjamin-hale.com.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with me about it, man. It sounds like
Absolutely.
a
Thank you.
great book.
Thanks for
All
having me.
right.
It's been a lot of fun.
I think I disclosed this in the actual interview, but this was not the Benjamin Hale that I thought I was going to
I
be
know you
talking
have
to.
a friend named Benjamin.
Who is a very good author as well. So I was still excited to talk to Benjamin. So his whole scenario is really interesting, and he knows every detail of it, which I wonder, do you think sometimes knowing all the details about your story or about the event or whatever that you're writing about, can that sometimes be detrimental? Is it a big positive? Like, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it's good to know all the details about it,
Yeah.
right? But as long as you don't put them all on the page.
That's the danger, yeah.
What he was saying was like, oh, he understood what he couldn't use, like why it had to be
Yeah.
changed for his novel because it was too coincidental and it, you know, it didn't make sense from a fiction perspective. So I don't think you can have too many details, but I think you can misuse them or put too many on the page, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's like anything where like if you research like how something works, right? Like they don't want you to
Yeah.
info dump about like an engine or, you know, quantum mechanics. Like they want it in like what's relevant to the plot and, you know, what connects the pieces for the reader, what just make enough to have it make sense in the context of the story, which can be hard, especially when you feel like, no, this is important, but is it?
Yeah.
But you could tell that he's been telling this story for a very long time. You know, just
Yeah.
at parties with friends when he got introduced to somebody. For me, just listening to it, and I'm guessing it's just like having a daughter, like it was difficult for me to get through that interview just
Yeah.
hearing that story because you immediately start to picture your own kids in there. And then that got me to thinking about, you know, what he initially said. Like if he wrote this as a fiction story, you know, it's okay. You know, it's a good story, but it's not something we haven't heard before. But then as soon as you hear that it's a true story, like that
Yeah.
makes it so much more compelling. You know, like that really draws you in.
Well, that brings up a good question because, like, how do you decide whether a story should be fiction or nonfiction? Like, should he have fictionalized this more, or, you know, where do you decide that?
I think it's because it's not really his story, but it's sort of his story. You know, it's his family story. Like, I think he's okay writing this as nonfiction. But like, if I were to read about this story somewhere and decide that I want to turn it into a book, I would feel more comfortable writing it as a fiction story, just because I don't know all the players, I don't know all the people, I don't know the things that he's leaving out.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's in my mind, that's where the line is.
Yeah. Didn't Stephen King write a book about A Girl Getting he's Lost got in the Woods.
Yeah, the Tom Gordon one.
Tom Gordon.
It's a fantastic story. I mean, it's just this little girl wandering around in the woods, mm-hmm. you know, basically talking to her imaginary friend. I mean, very similar to this, but it's one of King's best.
Yeah. So when you're writing something like this, what responsibility do we have when we're telling a real story that involves like real trauma and real living people and sensitive material? What's our responsibility?
Well, that's where it gets tricky. You know, like we talk about this murder that I solved, you know, back in 2009. And I've got a book that's totally done, that's sitting on my computer, and I haven't put it out because so many of the people in there, you know, like they're real people. You know, this girl who is a friend of mine, she's got kids. They're grown adults now. Like they're living this story, like that's part of their life. And like, I feel like I can't put it out without their blessing, without talking to everybody that's involved. You know, I think that's, you know, it's important because like, it's really not my story to tell. And this isn't, you know, to a certain extent it's his, but it's also not, because if he's naming names, you know, do those people want to be named? Do they want to be, you know, put down on paper forever as part of this?
Yeah. I have a similar scenario because there's a book I've been threatening to write since I met my real father, my actual father, when I was 38 years old. So that was, you know, quite a ways back now. And I'm not going to do the math, but I met my paternal grandfather just before meeting him. And there was this whole thing about a puzzle ring. And so there's this whole family drama thing that my wife and I both think would make a great book, but to write it means naming or at least implying certain names. And I don't want to offend these people. So I know none of them listen to the show. So I'm basically just waiting for a lot of them to die. I mean, I don't mean that mean. I'm just waiting them out. And then I'm going to write the book.
Yeah.
If I don't go.
Okay.
First.
All right. Well, you know, sometimes you just have to wait for people to die.
Wait for people
in a mean
to die.
Way.
It solves a lot of problems, honestly.
Mm.
So what do you think novelists can learn? Because he has a journalistic method, like interviews and things like that. What do you think you can learn from that sort of journalistic method, interviewing and digging through records and chasing leads and that sort of thing? What can novelists take away from that?
I think they can take a lot. I mean, as far as like outlining and like, I guess if you examine your fiction book in that way, it's probably going to help you figure out what's necessary, what's not necessary, maybe what, you know, plot holes that you might have, things that maybe don't really make a lot of sense that you might be able to tighten up. I think like kind of stepping back and looking at it from a more analytical perspective can never hurt, honestly, because I think we spend so much time in the creative, you know, the voice and the, you know, the beats and the this and the that. But if you really kind of step back and look at it from like, how can I tear it apart? You know, you'd probably end up making the story a lot leaner and meaner and better, I think.
I think you can never go wrong interviewing experts either, right? Like, that's always going to make your story better and more believable. Yeah. I mean, you think you know things, looking things up on the internet, until you talk to an expert, and then you realize you sort of got it, but not really. And so I definitely think that's a good way to go.
I learned a lot about this when I was writing memoirs, because I would sit down with, you know, whoever this memoir was for, and I would interview them, and we'd get, you know, hours and hours of tapes, and then I would transcribe those tapes and then whittle down what actually needed to be in the book. And you'd be surprised how much like that person thinks needs to be in the book versus what really is interesting, what really is something like an outsider really cares about. And it tends to be two very different things.
Yeah. I think I've probably used a journalistic skills quite a bit in at least the research side of things. You know, I think it would be useful for novelists to kind of use the when, where, how, what approach that you're taught in journalism, you know, because you would effectively, you'd go looking for things that support like why your characters are behaving the way they're behaving.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah. So yeah. All right. Well, right. That's pretty much it. I don't have
awesome.
Any
okay.
questions to follow on that.
Well, that's good because we're at the perfect time. JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Ian McGuire coming on. Ian's the author of numerous novels. He's also an instructor at the University of Manchester Center for New Writing. His latest book is called White River Crossing and releases February 24th. Ian McGuire.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.